Hey, happy 4th of July weekend. It's great to be with you. I love the 4th of July. I'm not sure which camp I'm in. Probably depends on the season of my life. For me, the 4th of July, or America, kind of came alive for me when I was 5 years old, five or six. We took a family trip. I grew up in Colorado, so we took a family trip, and it was down into Texas and across the Gulf Coast into Florida. My mom had a convention to go to in Miami, and then went up the East Coast and went to all these places. My dad is originally from upstate New York, so we went there, and then we worked our way back across the United States, back to Colorado. But when we were coming up the East Coast, we went to a place called Williamsburg, Virginia. How many people have been to Williamsburg? Yeah. Williamsburg, it captured me as a six-year-old. I was just like, this is so cool. I don't know, somehow it grabbed me. And so when I went to university and I was trying to figure out what to major in, I started in biology, and that lasted exactly one class the very first day. I was like in this big lecture hall, and the guy up front, I didn't understand one concept he was talking about. I didn't understand one word he said. He was a visiting professor from the Middle East, and his accent was so thick, I had no idea what he said. And I remember walking out of the class, and I was just like, okay, something's got to change, you know? And I walked out, and I started walking down the sidewalk, and in front of me was the girl I dated all through high school, and she dumped me on graduation night. What are you laughing about? And she dumps me. Yeah, totally, it was funny. And she's hand in hand with the captain of the track team. I am still hurt, you know. And then I walk back to my dorm room, and my new roommate, who I'd only known a couple of days, he's laying on the couch listening to John Denver on a record player and smoking dope. I'm thinking, okay, college is not going well. You know, I'm one class into it. I'm changing my major. I've been reminded of the painful breakup with my girlfriend. And I have this roommate who's smoking dope. And it was enough that it was coming out underneath the doors. I mean, he's like totally token up, you know. And it's, oh, well. All that back, when I couldn't figure out what to major in after biology, I finally thought, you know, what I really love is history. What I really, really love is history. And what I really, really love is colonial history. And one of the secondary parts of that I really love, was my emphasis, was in black history. Because I'd grown up watching that and seeing that whole thing. And my dad was a very, very, he's a great model for me. He was a high school baseball coach. They won the state championship, and he won the state championship with this team he called the United Nations. And it was this unique combination of white players, black players, Hispanic players, and Asian players, which at that point in 1961, whatever, was really weird in America. And my dad opened up, started the Human Rights Commission in my hometown, believing in the need for human connection and for the breaking down of the barriers that happen. And I think ever since that time, as being a 5-6-year-old in Williamsburg, Virginia, a love for what God wants to do among people really captured me. Now, I know we don't live in a perfect nation. Our nation has had its ups and downs over the years. It's a government for the people and by the people. And any time it's for people and by people, and when people get involved, it's going to have a broken edge to it, right? Of course it is. And it's going to have ups and downs. But this is, I think, the greatest experiment in human government and democracy and the value of people that the world has ever seen. I think we're going through a tough time right now. And so that's discouraging to me. But I also know it's life. It has its ups and downs, and I'm not quitting and giving up. But I also know that when you have a government for God and by God, it's a much better thing. And so that's what we're talking about today, is what is that supposed to look like? So if you're new this morning, here's what we've been doing. For the last 250 years, we've been doing a series in Matthew. And there's a purpose why we're doing it. But this particular section of Matthew, chapters 21 and 22, we're calling Kingdom Conflict. This is the very last week of Jesus' life. So he comes into Jerusalem in the triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, everything's exciting, Hosanna to the King, everything's really up, and then the whole thing goes downhill for a week. and it ends in his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion, which is actually an execution headed towards, thank goodness, the resurrection. But during that week, there are all sorts of very unique things that happen. So today we're going to talk about chapter 22, verses 23 to 40. Okay, and now when I started looking at this, the concept of what came out was really kind of, what about today and then what about the future? And for some reason it hit my mind is that candy called Now and Later. I don't know if you guys, I don't know, I'm a weird guy. I have weird thoughts, you know. And the Now and Later, how many people ate Now and Later growing up? Yeah, okay, yeah, you guys don't have any fillings anymore because it's like taffy. It'll pull your tooth right out of your mouth, you know. But I thought it's really the concept of today is this now and this later. But on a more serious level, it made me begin to think about some really fundamental things. I think the four vital questions that every person has to wrestle with. Every person on planet Earth actually is responsible for dealing with four primary questions. You got to think about it. You got to have an opinion. You got to have some sort of thinking. And if you're not really being a responsible person. The first question is this, is what is the origin of life? Now, obviously, there's a tremendous debate in our country or in our world about what is the origin of life. But you got to wrestle with that. You got to think about it. Where does it come from? Where does life itself come from? Where does my life come from? You got to think about it. Secondly, what is the purpose and the meaning of this thing called life? It's fundamentally important that everybody think that through. Try to come up with an answer. It's not just getting up every morning and doing something and then going to bed every night and repetitively doing that year after year. It can't be the purpose of it. You got to really think that through. Third question is, where do you find a moral structure for life? Where do you find something that says, here's how I'm going to live my life, and I'm going to line it up with this? Where do I find that? Is there some external moral structure that I could adopt? Do I make up my own? Is there none whatsoever, and so I just do it however I want to, and it all changes? It's a fundamental question. We all have to think it through. And that last one is this, is what is the destiny of life? Where's this thing headed? What happens? We all wrestle with it, right? Of course we do. What is the destiny? What happens when it comes to an end? Whether it happens, quote unquote, prematurely or in a typical timing, what happens? What's that all about? Is it just annihilation? And that's it? And all this really thoughtful, incredible stuff that we went through for all these years ends in nothing? Is that what it is? Or is there something after that? Those are four questions. Now, I'd like to add today a fifth question. I think is really important. And it's not I haven't crafted it really succinctly, almost on purpose, okay? I think here's the fifth question, is what do I do with this sense that I have of my own lack of intactness? What I mean by that is maybe this, is what do I do with this brokenness in my own person? That I'm not as intact, I'm not as connected, I'm not as consistent as I wish I was, as a human being, right? It's a really critical thing we wrestle with. What do I do with this tendency that I have to do the things that I don't want to do? What do I do with that? I mean, I'm kind of convicted it is wrong, but I still do it. Or what about not doing the things that I think I should do? I should do that, but I don't do that. What do I do with that inside of me? What do I do with this missing the target of what life was supposed to be, whatever that might be, right? I mean, who knows what that target is, or at least you might wonder, what is that target? But what happens when I miss that thing? What happens when I miss the target or I miss the perfection of what God is all about, which I clearly have done a zillion times? But I even miss, not only do I violate what he's about, I violate what I think I'm about. What do I do with that part of me? What do I do with that internal angst that I live with day in and day out? What do you do with that? To me, it seems like that's a really critical question that we all have to wrestle with. So, in this gospel of Matthew, which is really, in the big picture, a handbook for discipleship, which is not a class or a project or a program or boxes to check. It is a person to be. It is a surrender of my life to a glorious Christ. That's what it's all about. And so the whole book of Matthew is trying to outline what that looks like. Okay? So, we're going to jump into today's passage. But let me just kind of remind us where we just came from. Because the first line of this says that on the same day that whatever happened in the passage before, this is a continuation. So let's look at it. Matthew 22, verses 15 to 22. This is all about a conflict of authority during this last week of Jesus' life. And he says this, or here's the idea in that last passage, that more important than the image on the dollar bill or the image that's on the denarius of the Roman coinage, it is the fact that we, you and I, are made in the image of God. Now, we are not God. We're made in his image, and that we have qualities that he has, that he has given to us, and he has imprinted on us his image. The ability to love. The ability to create. The ability to have responsibility. To be given dominion over this world. That's what he gave us, is dominion. He took his creation, and he said, hey, you guys, you run it for me. Now, how crazy was that, right? But he says, here, you have dominion over this. Treat it right. Do it well. Wow. We are made in his image, and our responsibility is to give back to him that which he has given us. And that's our very lives and everything about our lives. He says, I want it back. I'll give it back. It's a proper relationship. So, from there, we jump into verse 23. Let's look at this. On the same day, so the same day that happened, and that happened, if you'll remember, not just the Pharisees, but the Pharisees' internships, the interns, their trainees had come to Jesus and asked him about giving taxes to Caesar. But on that same day, then, it says the Sadducees. Now, it's important that we understand who these guys are. Okay, so let's stop for a second. Who's a Sadducee? Now, the Sadducees were this. They were a religious sect, a branch, if you will. They were kind of a religious/political party in Israel. And if you were a member, or if you're a Sadducee, you tended to be an aristocratic kind of elite section of Israel. And it's, the high priest usually came from the party of the Sadducees. Now, they were distinguished for their birth, wealth, and official position. They welcomed political favor of the aristocratic and liberal branches of the Herodians. The Herodians are those who kind of lined up with the Roman government, and of the Romans themselves. And they hated the common people. They were opponents of the Pharisees, who we'll talk about in a little while. They rejected tradition. They advanced a more progressive approach to spirituality, if you will. They denied the resurrection. They said there's nothing after death. It's just annihilation. They denied the immortality of the soul or any accountability for the actions that we had here in life. So, there was no eternal consequence. There was just live your life. The consequence you have right here might be the only one you ever get because there's no such thing as a resurrection. And they denied the existence of anything beyond here, like angels or spirits. That's who the Sadducees were. So it's important to understand that because the question they're going to come to Jesus with is totally hypocrisy. They ask a question they don't even believe in at all. So look at this. Let's go back. The same day, Sadducees came to him, and let's highlight this, who say that there is no resurrection, right? So they're coming to him, and they don't believe in the resurrection, but look at this. And they asked him a question, verse 24, saying, Teacher, hey, Moses, so they refer back to the Old Testament, Moses said this, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, in our day and age, we go, that's kind of weird. You know, it's kind of strange. But let me just say, in Deuteronomy chapter 25, they call it Levirate marriage, which is really intended to perpetuate the honor of the name and the property ownership of a family, as well as to protect the wife or the mother in that situation. So if your husband died, gals, the brother would be responsible to marry you because they wanted to perpetuate not only his name, to honor him, but his part of the property ownership and for the woman's protection. Because in that culture, a woman was under the covering of a family. And by herself, she would have a very difficult time making it. And so to cover her, to provide for her, the brother would marry her. So now let's look at this, verse 25. And he says this. Now, they're asking a question. Now, were there seven brothers among us? The first married and died, and having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. So too, the second and the third, and down to the seventh. And after all of them, the woman died. So then they ask the question, verse 28, in the resurrection, circle that. In the resurrection, Jesus. Of course, they don't believe in the resurrection, right? They're like, oh, in the resurrection. So they're trying to prove him wrong. They're trying to say how silly this idea of resurrection is. How crazy can you be? And so they say, in the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had had her. Well, it's a reasonable question, I guess, but especially it's not reasonable if you don't believe in the resurrection, but they're trying to catch him in all of this, right? Okay, so let's go to verse 29. And Jesus answered them, and he said, you are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. Now, let's highlight that. Let's hold it to itself. He says, you don't know the scriptures, and you don't know the power of God. This is not a way to make friends, all right? So, okay, he says, you guys are wrong. You guys are ignorant. You don't even understand. You guys who think you're so cool in the scriptures, you don't even understand the Bible. You don't even understand the Old Testament, he says to them. And nor that, you don't even understand God himself and his power. Wow, okay, well, let's look at it then. So let's go to the scriptures first. He kind of comments on this in verse 30, the scriptures. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Now, the scriptures teach that in heaven there isn't marriage. Now, I don't know about you, but there's a piece of that that's disappointing, right? You're like, bummer, you know? We kind of did life together here. Why won't we do life together there, you know? And I don't know exactly what it looks like, but what he's saying is there's no propagation in heaven. There's no producing more children, as opposed to what some religions do teach, the celestial marriage, that you'll have even heavenly children, and you're going to have your own planet. And it's some crazy stuff that's not inside the scriptures. They're in other scriptures. They're in other books that people adopt. But he says, no, you know what? In heaven, there's no such thing as marriage. So this question you're asking about whose wife she's going to be is unimportant. It doesn't happen. It's not what the scriptures teach. You don't even know what the Bible's all about, you guys. And he says, we're like angels in heaven. It doesn't say we're angels. Because we're like them and that we don't propagate the species there. But we'll be focused on a relationship with God, and somehow we will know each other too. Exactly how that looks, we're all going to have to wait to see exactly what that looks like. But he says you didn't understand the scriptures. Now look at this in verse 31. It's going to be the more the power of God they don't understand. And as for the resurrection of the dead, Jesus says, have you not read what was said to you by God? And he's going to refer again to the Old Testament. He's going to say, I am, and I want to circle that for a second. That, I think, is the key phrase. I am. He doesn't say I used to be or I was or I could be, but he uses the present form, the present tense of the verb. I am the God of Abraham. He goes, do you not understand? This, their lives, Abraham may have died, but he is resurrected. I am the God of Isaac. He may have died, but he lives again. I am the God of Jacob, because life is eternal, he says to them. Life has an eternity to it. And the reality is, the scriptures teach that every person will exist forever, either in his presence or in his absence, that every human soul has eternity built into it. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And look at this. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. He's saying there is a resurrection, you guys. I know you don't believe it. You're trying to trick me. And just so you know, there's no marriage in heaven. But I'm telling you, this eternity is reality. And he is the God of the living and not of the dead. Wow. Now you guys, wow is right. Because look in verse 33. And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished. Highlight that. Remember last week? Remember what they said about Jesus? They marveled at what he said. thumazo, right? Tetshazay. It blew their minds. Guess what happens again? The Sadducees are astonished. The new Greek word, ekpleso, it means to strike out or to be struck with panic, meaning to be totally amazed. They are amazed at what Jesus said. And they're dumbfounded. They're at a loss for words. It causes them to gape in astonishment, in amazement at what he said. Wow. Are we amazed by what Jesus said? Or do we just kind of take it in stride and move on? But they were blown away. So he's saying there is eternity, that you and I will exist forever. Death is not the end. So we look at our tombstones, and it has a date and a dash and a date, but it really should be a date and a dash and a date and a dash for forever. So it just keeps going. It's an eternity. Now, let's go to verse 34. But when the Pharisees, of course, they don't want to be left out, right? The Pharisees. Hey, the Sadducees got their day. They got their thing. Now the Pharisees step in. Now it's important for us to understand then a Pharisee. So the Pharisees are this. It's another religious sect, a branch, if you will, another religious political party, if you will, that's kind of at odds with the Sadducees. They are properly, it's understood, the word Pharisee means a separatist or a purist. Even nationalistic, they were separatists and purists. They were so angry at the Romans for being there. They were not happy campers. They hadn't saddled up next to them like the Sadducees had. They were keeping their distance from them. The word from Aramaic means to divide or to separate. It literally refers to a separatist, meaning that the Pharisees somehow saw themselves, even personally, as separated from sin. They had a bit of an egotistical, I've reached perfection kind of attitude and approach towards life. Unfortunately, this can very easily devolve, can't it? When you feel almost like you're too pious, it can devolve into a religious conservatism, even a religious legalism. And they added just all sorts of rules in hopes that they would be recognized for their purity and their piety. And it turns into kind of an arrogance. And it kind of separates them from people. So the Pharisees, let's go back, verse 4 to 34. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, so evidently in a group of them, they came to Jesus, and one of them was kind of the lead sled dog on this, okay? And he's a lawyer or an expert in the law, and he comes and he asks Jesus a question. And remember, look at this in verse 35. He comes to test Jesus. He doesn't come with an inquiring mind. He comes with a kind of an adversarial mind, and he tests Jesus with this word. And he says, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Which one is the great one?" Now, you guys, here's the deal. The Pharisees, the reason this doesn't fit, because in a sense the question's reasonable, right? Which one's the top one? What's the most important? They believed in all of them as being equally important. You had to do everything right. And so if you're going to eliminate it down to one, they'd know, see, you don't really believe in the law. You're just kind of cherry picking. And they wanted them to say, they're all important. You've got to do everything just important. And they had added hundreds of laws to God's law. You know, and they had just, it's like, hey, it's make sure you don't smoke. Make sure you don't chew. Make sure you don't drink. Or no, you don't drink, don't smoke, don't chew. Don't take girls who do. You can't do any of those things, right? And so you don't get to do any. There's a lot of rules. But Jesus answers them very strategically in verse 37. He said to him, and you guys, let's highlight this. The first one is this. He says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your mind. This is the great and first commandment." You guys, that's nothing new. That was in the Old Testament. This is not new news to them. But they had gotten so wrapped up in their religiosity that they had forgotten the most important things, the highlighted things, the thing that really covers it all.
He says you need to love the Lord your God. You need to see who He is, honor who He is, love who He is, give yourself to Him in every way, shape, or form, with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, to love the Lord your God, the one who created you, the one who designed you, the one who made you for a purpose. Right? Starts answering the questions, the key questions of life. Where did that come from? Well, God created me. He made me just like I am. And even in this angst that I live with, He made me uniquely designed. He's got a plan for me. I can trust Him. I love Him. You know, we try to love all the other things of the world. And I don't know if you've ever tried to let other things love you or to love other things of the world. And at the end of it, it's such a letdown. It's such a disappointment. It never satisfies the human soul. Here He says, I want you to love me. That's the first and foremost commandment. And then He can't get away without adding to it. Look at this in verse 39. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Let's just stop there for a second. See, to love God is going to naturally and logically going to love other people. You have to. You can't love God and hate people. It doesn't work. Because what He is about is not only you, but He is about the person sitting next to you. He is about the person that sits on the bus next to you. He is about the person who sits on the plane next to you. He is about the person that is in your home. He loves them. And He wants you to love them too. They're hand in hand, right? You can't get away one without the other. It doesn't work. That's what we call hypocrisy. To say I love God but hate people, right? John comments on that in 1 John. You have to love people. So He says, the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then look at this incredible statement. And on these two commandments depends all the law and the prophets. Meaning, the entire Old Testament, everything in it, is wrapped up in the law and the prophets. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. To love your neighbor as yourself, as if they were you. Love them like you would like to be loved. Do unto others as they would have them do to you. Right? The golden rule. It's so simple. Just think, if we did that, if we treated other people like we'd like to be treated, guess what you could do? You could leave your keys in your car. Right? You could leave in the car. But no one's going to take it. You don't need locks on your door anymore. Because if you're going to love them like you love yourself, you don't want people breaking into your house and taking your stuff, taking your wife, taking your whatever. Right? Okay, man, I don't even need to lock it. The economy would change so drastically. We wouldn't need police. Right? Because I'm going to treat you right. You're going to treat me right. Wow, we've just lost it, haven't we? We're just so far from that. But to love the Lord your God and to love your neighbor as yourself. Wow. So, you guys, what do we do then? This is pretty simple stuff, you know, in a sense. And yet it's so complicated. So what do we do with this? Here's my thought. It's the gospel. The gospel. The gospel is the good news of God's engagement in the world that brings hope and purpose and meaning. The gospel is God engaging us. The whole thing, the whole gospel is really God putting His arms around and engaging us to guide us and to love us and to move us and to strengthen us and to invest in us. That is the gospel. The gospel of God's good news. And let me just put in parentheses small here. Especially exposed and expressed in the life of the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Son of David. God has revealed Himself in the person of Christ. He's given Himself to us. Isn't that like amazing? You think, if God were to show up and reveal Himself, we could think of all sorts of ways He could have done that. I always think, well, what if He could just, maybe the Goodyear blimp, you know? Maybe He could just fly it over and put the message on the side. But how impersonal would that be? Would it really change our lives? I think the only thing that would really change our lives is the fact that God showed up And he put his arms around me and he loved me dearly. And he gave me his spirit to live inside of me. That's the only way it was ever going to make sense. And he does it in the person of Christ. And I think that this gospel, it is vital and vibrant, both now and later, right? That's what this passage has just said, that the gospel is vibrant and vital now and later. Now, in this passage, he went later first, so let's just flip him. He went later, which is this eternity is real, and his presence in our lives can be real, and it's vibrant and vital now as love defines it all, right? He says, hey, you guys, there really is eternal life. And I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And I am your God too. And I created you for eternity. I put eternity in your hearts. And I'm doing it. Wow. And before that happens, in the now, is love defines us. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And to love your neighbor. To love your neighbor. Love him in truth and in grace. Tell him the truth. Do it graciously. Be gracious and tell them the truth. I want you to love people, guys. Wow. You guys, I think it goes back to the four vital questions, right? Look at this again. These four vital questions. What is the origin of life? The one who created us. The one who says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The one who has always been, who is, and will always be. The one who knit you together in your mother's womb. I created you. Where do I come from? Because God is the one who defines it. What is the purpose and the meaning of life? Is to do the very things in the now that he called us to do. But to love the Lord your God and to love your neighbor as yourself. And to do that, seek the welfare of the environment and the culture in which you live. Seek them. Bless them. Love them. Sacrifice them. Wow. Where do I find a moral structure for life? It's built on the love of Christ and all that he is about, what he values, who he is, who we follow. And last, what is the destiny of our life? There is eternal life. It'll either be in his presence or it'll be in his absence. Our prayer and hope is it would be in his presence. Because the fifth question, what do I do with this sense of brokenness, this lack of intactness, this inconsistency in my life of doing the things I don't want to do and not doing the things I should do? What do I do with all of that? Well, that's why Christ came, right? That's why Christ was given, to take my brokenness and to make me whole, to take my unrighteousness and to give me his righteousness. And it was totally by his grace. He sent Christ to solve this most important question about what do I do with my broken world? How do I live it out? The change that he needed to do in my life. In my life, that happened, at least it may be initiated in high school when I began to understand the difference between life and death and what to do with it when two of my friends and my cousin died unexpectedly. And I had no idea what to do with that. And I began to hear about Christ. He said, I came that you might have life and might have it abundantly. In other words, I think that it might be full and meaningful. And I thought, well, that's what I need and want because I can't figure this thing out called life and death. And since then, he's renewed that year by year, season by season, that I can't find another answer for the issues of life. I cannot find answers to these questions outside of the gospel that satisfy my soul. And I think that there's a whole culture out there that is dying literally to find these answers, to find it satisfying in their soul. And that's my hope and prayer, is that for now and for later, the gospel is what satisfies each one of us. I pray if you're here this morning and you've never made that decision or come to the solution of those or the answers to those questions being Christ, but you'd like to say, well, I think that's what I need too. I think I need him. If that's where you're at this morning, I encourage you to come talk to us. But it's just by faith as you put your life into his hands. And he said, I'm going to trust you. Come hell or high water, I'm going to trust you. I think that's where we're at. So, the reality is, we're going to sing that Jesus paid it all. The debt that I have before God, Jesus paid it. I didn't pay it. I didn't deserve it. I didn't do a thing. I'm just putting my faith in the fact that Jesus paid it all, right? So we all do. So, as we move into this, just bring yourself to the Lord together, individually and corporately. Let's thank Him for paying it all for us.